Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whichever applies to you when you're listening to this. This is Cinematica Season 4, Episode Number 4, and I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio are...
It's me, I'm back.
Yeah, we're going to be grilling you about the reasons for your absence a little bit later on. We're going to need a note from your parents to explain why you weren't here last week. And who else is over in the corner?
Kaylee.
Hello. In today's episode of the show, Robert Redford is back in the world of political thrillers in The Company You Keep. Beth Brash from eatandgreet.co.nz is going to help us review Haute Cuisine. Simon's going to tell us all about A Song for Marion. And I interview Petra Brett Kelly, the director of the New Zealand documentary Māori Boy Genius, which is making its way around the country at the moment. But first, before we get into any of that, what is in the mailbag for this week?
Well, Reese Pie, one of our listeners from the UK, says, here's my two-word review, potentially controversial, for Iron Man 3, Iron Meh.
Ooh, that's harsh.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
Dismissive.
Dun, dun, dun. I mean, it wasn't that bad. It was good. I liked it. I liked Iron Man.
Yeah. Well, you finally got to see it.
I did. Yeah. A week after you guys reviewed it, I think. But I liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And it is interesting because... I think not very many people are on that sort of mere fence like Reese Pie is. I mean, people who don't like it really don't like it, or they find quite concrete things to criticise about it. But just looking at the box office, I think, you know, those opinions are not shared universally, are they?
No. Barnaby HM says, re-watching the credits, I stay because I always learn something about how the film was put together, and Emma Curmudgeon.
Yeah, that's true. We on previous episodes of the show, we were talking about that idea of having something after the credits to keep you sitting there. And some of our listeners were not mad keen on that as a development. But
I would second that motion.
Yeah, well, you want to get on with your life, don't you? Really? Mm. And but it's interesting. You know, if you sit and watch all of the credits for Iron Man, what do you learn about how that film was made? It was made by a lot of people.
Mm.
That's the lesson, isn't it?
Mm.
A lot of people not paid
very much.
But
there's also a little bit of a thing at the end.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Mm. Is that yeah? I mean, it's worth staying for. It's worth staying for
it's
Iron
worth
Man.
Staying for the end.
But you know, I'm about to watch. Or tonight, maybe midnight, if I can really bring myself to do it. Star Trek. The new Star Trek at midnight.
Ooh.
The question is, do I stay for all through all of the credits? Because there's not really likely going to be any extra material at the end. Maybe not. But I mean, do I want to watch 5, 8, 10 minutes of credits?
I'm trying to
just in case.
I'm trying to decide if I want to shell out the money and go see it in IMAX in Auckland. If it is an IMAX in Auckland, because I'm going to be up there. So
I think it will be.
Yeah, it will be.
Yep.
Yeah. So if any of our Auckland listeners, you want to go on a Star Trek date. On like Friday, I'll be there.
That is a very attractive offer. Just on
well,
the subject,
thanks, Dan.
Yeah,
such a nice compliment.
He said struggling to find the words. I was just thinking about how we were talking about, you know, whether it's worth sticking around after the credits for stuff. And Beth Brash, who's actually going to be appearing on the show a little bit later on, tweeted us a link. There is an app for your iPhone that. Will tell you look up the name of the film and it'll tell you whether it's worth sticking around at the end. So
there is
to save your time, there is an app for that. Yeah, so you what you want is you want to put it on the same on your home screen alongside the one that tells you at what point in the movie it's safe to go to the toilet.
There's an app for that?
There's an app for that.
I need that. I really need that one. Speaking of bathroom breaks, the Mirka tweeted, Lawrence of Arabia, two-word review, epic perfection, which was screened as part of the autumn events.
Yep.
What an afternoon that was. Mm. Afternoon, early evening, actually, as it turned out, because it was a wee bit late starting, because it, you know,
was full.
It was chocker, and of course, you know, it takes a while getting everybody into their allocated seats there at the embassy. So it's a little bit late starting. Bill did make a little bit of a speech beforehand as well, so that pushes things out a wee bit. Then there was an overture. as well, which isn't part of the running time of the film. So that's another 5 or 6 minutes of music. And then there's an interval as well, 20 minutes of interval. So I was late for dinner at the end of that, but it was worthwhile, definitely. And I didn't realise until the day that the embassy here in Wellington have just installed a 4K projector. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was a 4K restoration. I thought that only Auckland was going to get the full majesty of the 4K presentation, but no, we got it. And I am sold. 4K wins for me. It was absolutely magnificent.
Oh, very good. Excellent. Very good.
And one last two-word review this week from Miriam Ruth Ross. Real Brazil Film Festival's Two Rabbits, Hyperactive Thriller.
Mm. Yes, indeed. And the Real Brazil Festival is running in parallel in Wellington, at least with the autumn event. So there's just so much.
A bit of an overlap there, eh?
Yeah, so much.
Was there anyone at character for Lawrence? Anyone dressed up in the...
No, it wasn't like...
prisoners!
No, but they did have the amazing travelling photo booth there.
Did you get...
Oh, yeah.
I have even on Facebook.
It's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are photographs. And this is one of the things that I'm starting to realise is that as a relatively minor local celebrity, I'm going to get dragged into these sorts of things. So I really do have to dress up.
Yeah. Look snappy.
I can't turn up in my football shirt and unshaven for these sorts of events anymore because people will go, oh, look, there's Dan. Let's take his photograph. No. not my usual Sunday afternoon attire. Anyway, so what apart from all of that, what have people been going to see this weekend? Is it three quarters Iron Man, 25% the rest? How's that been going?
Well, opening at number 5 this week, actually a little bit surprising, Jurassic Park 3D.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Right in the top 5.
Yeah. Because it's not that wide either.
It was limited screenings too. Yep.
Mm. Yep. Way to go. Down to 4 from 3, Oblivion. Up to 3 from 5, Escape from Planet Earth. Sitting at 2, The Croods. And of course, in the number 1 position, Iron Man 3.
Wow. And I noticed from the US that Oblivion dropped something like 70%. From week 2 to week 3, mainly I would imagine because the market for that film, we're all going to Iron Man. You know, it's that big blockbuster market. But Tom Cruise did well to get his film out with a couple of weeks.
You'd expect to see a drop from Thursday as well here. I mean, once Star Trek opens.
Yeah, exactly. All right, this is we live in interesting times. Robert Redford is back on our screens with a new thriller, and a couple of us, I hope, went to see it last week.
How dare you show up here?
Where else could I go?
You're taking a hell of a chance.
Not by choice.
They're probably watching me, unlike you. They know who I am.
How's that working out, though?
You. I have a life.
I was hoping for a little bit more. Hey, Nick, old friend, how are you? How have you been these past 30-odd years?
Christ's sakes, Nick, I'm a public figure. Do you know the position you're putting me in here? Nancy would forgive me banging a freshman sooner than talking to you.
You're still with Nan?
Yeah, some of us made it work.
Okay, Robert Redford on the run, on the lam, as they say, as a... well, I'll let Kaylee describe it for you, because it's quite an intricate wee plot.
It is. So Robert Redford stars and actually directs this little political thriller. He was part of the Weather Underground back in the day, a group of radicals involved in the shooting and killing of a bank security guard. And he has been on the run for the past 30 years when one of his other co-conspirators, I suppose, played by Susan Sarandon, gets busted just before she's about to turn herself in. So he goes on the run from the FBI. So the FBI is after him. Meanwhile, this savvy reporter, played by Shia LaBeouf, wants to get to the bottom of the story and sort of puts together the pieces of who these people are. Even though the FBI haven't figured it out for 30 years, he's going to do it. Sort of in like The Wire, I guess, where it's like the reporters are actually better at policing than the police.
Yeah. And it's also, it's kind of old-fashioned in that it's similar to that Woodward and Bernstein investigative reporter who also knew much more than the authorities did about how these things work. They follow the money, etc., etc. And LaBeouf plays a reporter, a real old school reporter. You sort you sort of half expect him to sort of walk out with a trilby with a press card in the brim.
He'd look good. It would suit him.
Yeah, but he's. It was just one of the things about the film that I felt was a little bit old fashioned, really, because. You know, they do allude to the fact that times are tough in the newspaper business, but there was really there's not much that relates to, you know, the way modern news is broken. You know, the newspapers stories don't get broken on the front pages of newspapers anymore. They get followed up on the front pages, or they get summarized. The web is where breaking news happens nowadays, and they didn't seem to acknowledge that very much at all. But as we know from past experience, Robert Redford is one of the great Hollywood lefties, and his politics are very progressive, and he likes to sort of slip those politics into his mainstream movies. And I think that there's enough sort of discussion about what the Weather Underground were protesting about, and reminding or teaching some young audiences that there was American domestic terrorism in the 1970s. That wasn't a relatively recent development, and that those terrorists were fighting what some people still consider to be the good fight.
Yeah, so it's quite a loaded cast. You have Susan Sarandon, Shia LaBeouf, and of course Robert Redford, along with Stanley Tucci, Gary Cooper. Everybody. Mm. Everybody's in this film, really.
Yeah, definitely. And Nick Nolte.
Oh, gosh.
Who needs subtitles.
Yeah.
And you, everybody gets a... I worried a little bit about the script for this, because there were a lot of people turned up and then disappeared.
Mm.
You know, Susan Sarandon's character is absolutely crucial to the way that the film starts, the way the plot is launched, and she has a big scene where she sets the scene for everything, and then she just disappears.
Mm.
Yeah. We don't even hear about her afterwards. Julie Christie turns up as well, and it just seemed to me that it was very episodic. That nowadays we expect our thrillers to have much more propulsion to them, much more scene leading into scene leading into scene. But it was kind of it just seemed a little bit old fashioned, really.
But do you think there's an element of that where, or in this film, where it's trying to capture a time when people were more active? More, and there were mass movements, against, what governments were doing. Whereas now it's kind of, you could argue that it's more about what the Kardashians are doing, and there's mass movements about that, and the politics, is one-liners, and that's how it gets sold.
Yeah, I think it's very nostalgic about those times, and I think some of those discussions that that Redford's character has with his former co-conspirators as he drifts around the country trying to find the answers to his situation, you can see that these are pensioners, basically, looking back on when they really cared about stuff, and some of them don't care about it as much as they used to, Some of them are quite happy to have drifted into a secure sort of retirement, like Richard Jenkins' character from the audio that we heard a little bit earlier on. He's quite happy to rest on the laurels of his former activism without having to do very much about it nowadays.
Exactly. My favorite part, obviously, was the fact it was filmed in Vancouver pretty much entirely. So I got to sit there and be like, I've been there. I know where that is. I know where that is.
So Vancouver was standing in for the Great Lakes, the American side of the Great Lakes, Midwest.
Yeah. And not the sort of big exterior shots of New York, but New York as a city as well. So...
Oh, really?
It does it all.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. There's a scene where Gary Cooper and Robert Redford are about to meet. And I was like, oh, he's just like four blocks up the road. You can just walk. You don't need to take a cab.
So did they go to New York for the subway?
Nope.
That's Vancouver subway.
That's Vancouver with stickers over top. That's actually the Granville Street station underneath Pacific Center and the bay.
The magic of the movies, ladies and gentlemen.
Just on about the magic of movies, it was funny, the other day we got Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, watched it with the kids, and then we started talking about how they were doing things, is she driving that car? No, she's not. It's actually, you look at the way she's playing with the steering wheel, and it's
and the car doesn't move.
Yeah, that's right. So it's bolted onto the back of a truck or something like that, and it's being filmed.
And do your kids now hate you?
No, they don't. But it was really interesting that... they've been so bombarded with digital films and the way that worlds are created that they actually kind of found that really interesting. That it was a fascinating kind of mindset.
I think you're absolutely right that nowadays kids are used to these things being created in computers, but the idea that you would actually go and practically make those things, you would stick a car on the back of a truck.
Yeah, I mean, there's the balloon scene in Chitty Chitty Bang, when the car flies off and the Germans arrive in a little mini balloon Zeppelin thing, and that's all kind of cranes and stuff flying around in the air. And I mean, it's funny, it's really funny how that would just not, it's just no way on earth that would happen now.
I was really disappointed when I found out that the movie Gangster Squad, that they used digital blood all the way through it. Because there were some quite bloody scenes where those machine guns are turned on people, but it's all digital because there's no cleanup, right? So if you need to go cut, reset, you can start again in no time at all, and you can understand the practical reasons behind it. But it's a real disappointment to know that they're not wiring up actors like they did with James Caan in the Godfather, with those squibs that that burst. I mean, I thought that was really super cool in those days, and something's been lost, I think.
I think so. And it is funny when you're actually sitting there and you're talking about this film and you're explaining it to them, and they kind of, and you start thinking, well, this is actually so, it's becoming an antique, that way of making a film. And you sort of think, yeah, okay. But it wasn't that long ago. It really wasn't that long ago.
No, exactly. Speaking of antiques, Kayleigh, Robert Redford, are you familiar with the man's work? Do you know how far back he goes? Have you seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
I've not seen Butch Cassidy, but I am familiar with his work because my mom totally had a crush on him. So, yeah, I know.
But is this like a... Because wasn't it... Was it Sneakers?
Sneakers, yeah, that's 20 years ago. Yeah.
But
yeah.
It sounds kind of...
It's similar. Yeah. Sneakers was one of those early tech thrillers where they were hacking into...
Is ridiculous.
But they were also... activists who get caught out at the beginning. That whole sort of premise is there in that film.
Well, I think he is an old school Hollywood lefty, and he does try and
middle
sneak
middle kind of the road, really.
By American standards, I think he would probably be pretty progressive.
That's a bit of a worry.
There's another film that you might have heard of that was about a similar sort of theme, and that's Running on Empty, which starred River Phoenix
in the
late 80s, which was also about a family on the run from. They'd been in hiding, and so it's not the first time that this story has been told. But
he seems to like it.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right. And certainly, the idea of citizens, acting against their government, against the government that's not acting in your own best interests or the community's best interests. I think that's pretty a big deal for him. He's 76 years old now.
You can see it.
You can, can't you? There's some scenes where he goes running.
I didn't believe it for a second.
Because actually, his butt.
Well, because when he walks, he walks like an old man now.
Yeah.
He walks like somebody whose balance is slightly like where you sort of check your footing.
Oh, geez, I'm like that now.
but he doesn't have that sort of movie star, like he was the biggest movie star on the planet for a long while, and that smile that was lit up movie screens. And I just wonder whether Clint Eastwood is older, and Clint Eastwood has been playing, but he's been playing old men for a long time. He's acknowledged what's happened to him and to himself and what's changed. Whereas I think that Redford, he's playing the widowed father of a 12-year-old girl, and they don't talk about age much. Mm. But with the dyed hair and what have you, you get the impression that he thinks he's playing a bit younger than he actually is. Which is a little bit of a shame. I think we just need to get a bit realistic, please, everybody. Mm. Now, two words to sum up. Do we think we can go around the table?
Yeah, I think my two words. I just have to say, it wasn't all roses for me. I did find some of the dialogue a bit on the nose, is a bit, and some scenes were a bit clunky. But all in all, because of the stellar cast, and there's some nice little moments in it, my two word review will be Good Company.
All right. Well, my two for the company you keep are old-fashioned. And, you know, you can that's good, bad, depending on your point of view. Sorry, have you seen it?
No, I have to say I haven't.
You're helping us out there.
I was just helping you out.
Good stuff.
Yeah, Redford Rewind.
Oh, nice. Look at that.
Don't see it.
He doesn't even need to see it. He is on fire, ladies and gentlemen. Mm. All right. we are going to go to France now and talk about one of those...
It's like the young ones. We just jump up in the air and bing, we've landed.
Yeah, that's right. Or we could travel by...
I can do that.
Or like the Muppets, we could travel by map.
Yep. hey, just an idea. I sent it this the other day, you know. An idea for the Sevens would be to go as Ernie and Bert in costume.
In the Sevens?
Yeah. Well, let's throw that out there for people who like their rugby. And Cookie Bear. And Big Bird.
Cookie Monster.
Cookie Monster, if you're into that Sesame Street thing.
Yeah.
I am the only person around this table who has actually been Cookie Bear.
Yeah. Who is Cookie Bear?
Cookie Bear is Hudson the Cookie Bear.
I used to have a Cookie Bear membership.
Right. See, this is a New Zealand. These are New Zealand biscuits, right? These are New Zealand made biscuits.
Homogenized. That's another one.
I was Hudson the Cookie Bear. This is listeners. this is surprise about my past.
Hold on. You were. Or you dressed up as?
No, I was Hudson the Cookie Bear for a day Wellington Zoo for a promotion. And the suit was hot, as you could imagine. It also was kind of smelly and itchy. I don't know who'd been in it before me. But once I was told by...
what did you do to get in the character?
I was told that you put the head on...
Yeah.
You're not allowed to say anything other than dumpty-doo.
Dumpty-doo.
Right? Because it will spoil it for children, right? It will spoil the effect. So all of your communication with the outside world has to happen through the medium of dumpty-doo. So
dumpty-doo.
So it's dumpty-doo when you want the kids to go away.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And but it was...
I'm traumatized just imagining this.
I used to get a card every year, a birthday card from...
Well, there you go. This is what you miss out on. Your Canadian child.
Buy a packet of Shrewsbury's and you'll see him on it.
Oh, that guy.
That bear.
No, I didn't miss out because my dad used to dress up as Jerry the Moose. So I got to be real cool.
And I know who Jerry the Moose is.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's cool.
Mm. We had the suit in our basement for years. Yeah.
Right, well, we...
digress.
We digress once again. This is the digression show. but we'll stay on the subject of cuisine, shall we say.
Okay.
And let's chat to Beth Brash from Eden Greet about haute cuisine.
Ne parlez par quatre chemins. Le président de la République serait très heureux si vous acceptiez de vous occuper des cuisines privées de l'Élysée.
Je ne suis pas sûr d'être à la hauteur, vous voyez.
Le président pense le contraire. Les gens que vous croisez, vous les saluez, tous.
Madame...
Monsieur.
Je vais vous présenter Monsieur Le Pic, notre chef de cuisine.
Non.
Écoutez, on voit les présentations plus complètes une autre fois.
Joining us on the line from another corner of Wellington is Beth Brash, who is the publisher and editor of eatandgreet.co.nz. She's our food specialist reviewer here on Cinematica. Before we get into haute cuisine, Beth, could you explain to our listeners what Eat and Greet is?
Sure. So it's a website. It's a kind of, in a way, a review a restaurant review website, but instead of me being the expert, which I'm not, I thought, why not go and talk to the people behind this plate and find out their stories and let them kind of tell you why they love what they do and just kind of champion the people who are doing awesome stuff and going way beyond the call of duty to bring excellent food in this fair capital.
And so despite what John Key might have wanted to tell the world, the Wellington restaurant scene is not dead and neither is the rest of the capital.
Oh, man. I don't even know where to start with that. It just makes me my blood boil. But let's not get into politics.
Yeah, it's a challenge to rise to, isn't it? Let's talk about haute cuisine now, and this is a film that originally played in the French Film Festival a little bit earlier on in the year. It's now on general release, and it's the story of a woman who is plucked from sort of rural obscurity. She runs a sort of bed and breakfast in the country. She's chosen to run the private kitchen for the president of France, and it's all based on a true story. Beth, I thought the food looked very French. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, very French. It's all truffles and foie gras and butter and all that amazing stuff. Yeah, it was an absolute joy to watch all that. All the food. And although there was one dish that you didn't quite like, wasn't there?
Yeah, I'm not mad keen on salmon or cabbage, and to have cabbage stuffed with salmon was sort of adding insult to injury a little bit for me. But there were...
I found out later on that is actually Danielle, who the story is based on, her favourite dish.
Well, if I become the president of New Zealand and I get to choose who runs my kitchen...
I think you should, Dan, actually, after this, after everything that's happened.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm working my way up to it. And, so Mitterrand, he loved traditional cooking. He wanted sort of nostalgia on a plate, didn't he? He wanted mm-hmm. he wanted the tastes of his grandmother's cooking.
And so she's not even really asked. She's just kind of told... sort of scooped up and taken to France and sort of told that she's now going to be his private chef, which, of course, being a very male-orientated industry, pisses off all the chefs, no end, in the main kitchen, who are, of course, all men.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's a sort of subtle... subtext, isn't there, going on? It doesn't beat you over the head with its feminism, but you are, it's made pretty clear that she is a determined, feisty individual who won't take a backward step. It's a tough road for her.
It's just the truth of the industry, and what you do. I think she's a perfect example, and you find that. You do get these incredible women who are very strong and won't take no for an answer. And a great example was when she goes to Antarctica, and she was told she wanted to go. She decided she wanted to go to Antarctica for this job, and she was told that no, she was too old, and no, that she was a woman. And she was like, no, I'm going anyway. I'm an excellent reference.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. I mean, it's an interesting story.
It's not the most dramatic story in the world, though, is it?
No. And I really battled with this. I did enjoy it, but I don't know why. I kind of wonder why it was told in a way. Because I think with biopics, the thing that makes them so great is that they seem so unbelievable.
Mm.
And with this one, I was kind of like, oh, well, that's nice.
That's exactly right. If you were to go through all of the elements of the story and try and look at what might have been implausible, I suppose the very beginning, we're supposed to believe that it's a really unlikely thing that she would be chosen for this job, but you know, she had a reputation. She was well known in her field. I think another problem perhaps with the film, even though it presents the food extremely well, and I think that you could almost smell the dishes as they came out of the oven, because it's such nostalgic cooking, it's not the most exciting food in the world. It's not like she's changing French cookery or trying to transform the industry. In fact, she does a fairly good job of nearly killing Mitterrand with all of the butter and the cream. So she has to be told to tone it down.
I do really love that idea where she researches where he grew up and where his mum was from, and so the food that she used to cook, and so there is that thing that I love about food, which is how it can just evoke so many memories and nostalgia and that sort of thing. So it wasn't that I sort of struggled with. I think mostly I just struggled with the totally unnecessary documentary crew that were in Antarctica with them.
To frame the whole thing. It did seem like they were struggling to work out a way into the story, and that seemed to be a fairly not helpful, really. They weren't terribly Australian either, were they?
No, it was so strange. She's like, man, from Australia, or something. It was like really strange. I think it was like French Canadian. I was just like, you are the least Australian person I've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think, in a way, you know, those two stories, which are interlocked, but also quite, sort of removed from each other, they do. I think for me, they kind of showed this idea that food is love, and it's about sharing, and it's about family, and it's about community, and that's what food can do.
And so, and from her point of view, it's also about service, isn't it? You know, it's like she doesn't get to eat it. She doesn't get to eat until everybody else has eaten first. You know, it's not it's a gift.
Mm.
Which I think is true of many of the great chefs. You know, it's like show business. You know, you actors sort of wait in the wings, and they want to know that there's the laughter of the audience before they can relax. And I think that chefs obviously they're just as nervous about how their food's going to be responded to.
Yeah.
So do you recommend it, and do you have two words that you could use to describe it to people?
I would recommend it. I think, you can go, it'd be a nice sort of Sunday afternoon, go along with your mum and dad, go take your grandma, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, two words. I will say under-seasoned.
Oh, you're very good at this. My two words, and I'm not even sure if this, you correct me if this is not even a cooking term, but my two words are petit four.
Oh, yep.
Does that work?
That's a cooking term.
Good.
Yeah, sure.
Excellent.
Hey, one last thing.
Yeah.
And don't you think the president kind of looks like Hoggle from the Labyrinth?
If you were being distracted on that level, that was a sign that you were not totally engaged. I thought that he also spoke extremely slowly. Even with my high school French, I didn't need the subtitles for him.
But definitely go and Google the two, and you'll see what I mean.
Good one. All right, Beth Brash, thanks very much for your time.
No worries.
Behind-the-scenes legend Ray Harryhausen passed away this week at the age of 92. Harryhausen may not have invented the stop-motion method of animation, but he perfected it, providing magical effects for films like Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, 1 Million Years BC, and Clash of the Titans, the good version. Talking to TV3 earlier today, Sir Peter Jackson said, "The Lord of the Rings is my Ray Harryhausen movie without his lifelong love of his wonder... without... the lifelong love of his wondrous images and storytelling, it would never have been made, not by me at least."
That's quite a big deal. I know that we often on the news section of the show seem to talk about dead people, but that's Harryhausen, definitely a legend. And if you watch Monsters, Inc., you'll know that when Billy Crystal's character, I can't remember his name, goes on the big date, they go to Harryhausen's is the rest the name of the restaurant that they go to. So very, very influential. And there was a film called about Burke and Hare that came out with Simon Pegg a couple of years ago, and Harold Ramis, the director of that, it populated the film.
Star Simon Pegg.
Yes,
it did. Simon Pegg and Gollum.
Gollum, yeah,
yeah. Andy Serkis. Gollum.
That's sure right. But as extras in a couple of the scenes, he went and got a whole lot of great directors just to be extras in the scene. Mm. And but included in that was the was Ray Harryhausen, who actually got to appear on screen at least once before. Yeah, before he was living in England for the last sort of 50 years of his life and living and working in England. So yeah, cheerio, Ray.
Mm. Meanwhile, the world waits on tenterhooks for a trailer. Director Edgar Wright has been teasing us for days, and tonight, in New Zealand time, we expect to finally see the trailer for The World's End, the finale of the Cornetto trilogy. And my life! My whole life depends on this film.
And there was some Hayden Wheel, who I think listens to the show occasionally and I follow on Twitter, was deeply disappointed because he thought it was going to be last night, so he woke up this morning traumatized that it wasn't there for him. So he was actually tweeting Edgar Wright to say, come on, faster.
And speaking of good, exciting news and things arriving on time, the Sydney Film Festival announced their complete program this morning, as always giving New Zealand audiences a clue or three about what might be showing up at the NZFF in July and August. The festival opens on the 5th of June with new Oz thriller Mystery Road and closes 2 weeks later with the feel-good doco 20 Feet from Stardom about rock's greatest backing singers.
That looks so good.
Mm. Other highlights include a visit by Sarah Polley with her documentary Stories We Tell. The Canadian Film Festival Possible Worlds, which also takes place in Sydney, has announced their dates but no program yet. So I'm waiting on that.
Yeah. And that's not at the same time though, is it?
No, it's will be in August.
All right. Well, and have you had a chance to have a look at the Sydney Film Festival program? Have
look
you
at
got
my humongous
some
list?
Yeah, got some highlights there. Anything you want to sort of identify in advance? I had a quick look at this. The program is so big that the website is actually really cumbersome. It's not the there's no sort
are
of.
We all, but are we all on board for We Steal Secrets?
Of what?
We Steal Secrets.
Oh, which is the Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks
doco. WikiLeaks doco.
Doco. Yeah, there's so much good stuff going on.
I'm
there.
Up for that. I reckon that'd be quite interesting.
The documentary section is huge, actually.
Mm-hmm. And look, this thing here, I don't know anything about it, but I like the title, and that's what, you know, quite often that's what does it. Monsoon Shootout.
That sounds pretty.
Yeah. Pretty good. What else have we got? There are about half a dozen films in this list that I didn't see or were at telluride.
Speaking of documentaries, Blackfish about killer whales being kept in captivity. Very close to my heart. And also the documentary The Pervert's Guide to Ideology, which is about ideology in film and film history, which I think will be very interesting.
All right. Well, among the highlights for me here are Shane Carruth's new film Upstream Colour. This is the follow-up to
I heard
Primer.
A rumour that may actually be at NZFF.
Well, I think it's a bit more than a rumour because they basically said because that the film's actually been made available for legal download in the United States because it's been out for a while in the United States. So the NZFF were encouraging people to wait. Rather sensibly, I think. Also, Shopping. The New Zealand feature film from my cursory sort of look at the program, I think that's the only New Zealand feature in the program. Mm. There's a new film by Takeshi Kitano called Outrage Beyond. Oh, look, it's such a good, strong festival, and I do hope that we get more than our share of the titles.
Yes, and of course they're getting some big ones as well. Only God Forgives. Stories We Tell by Sarah Polley, who we mentioned will be at the festival. Mood Indigo, the new film by Michelle Gondry, will be there as well. Stoker, and the director and Mia Wasikowska will be there as guests. So,
And also they're going to be screening the complete Richard Linklater Before trilogy, Before Midnight, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, which could almost take place in completely in real time, couldn't it?
start
at a particular time of the morning, boom, you know, or miss start at midnight, whatever. Yeah. All very, very strong. But this is one of those first festivals that's so big that the website, I don't think, really gives you the full sort of idea of the scale.
Doesn't give the scale, no.
I found it really helpful to go down they have a left-hand menu and it's broken up into their sections. I found that was a really easy way to maneuver through all of these selections. But I think if there was one film that I would fly to Sydney to see, is I Am Divine, the documentary about Divine.
Wow. Mm. Learning more about you every week.
Uh-huh.
And you'd get the T-shirt, I Am Divine.
I would get the t-shirt. Yeah, I know. I hope there are t-shirts. Yeah. Well, oh, John Waters is there.
Yeah, if they haven't come up with a t-shirt, they should now. Yeah. Now, before we move on to the next part of the show, I would like to just ask Si, where were you last week? And why were you not with us?
And why didn't you bring us back duty free?
Yeah, you see, you set a standard and you got to keep doing it. Look, I was away at a conference in Australia, the ICA conference, which is a conference for independent cinema operators. And so we caught up for a week.
And what's the general sort of mood amongst the independents? Is business good?
Business is okay. It's not flat out. It's not, and I think, interestingly, in Australia, they experienced a similar kind of, pattern that we've had here, like post Oscar season. There was a bit of a drop off, no sort of big heavy hitter films coming in through at that time. They've come a bit later this year. So I think, they were just sort of, ruminating on that as well. And it was interesting, the similar sort of issues. And that is about, release patterns and the strength of the product at certain times of the year. And a lot of the focus also was, the lessons that we're all learning and converting to digital. So a lot of discussions about that.
And was this the kind of event where the distributors turned up to show you stuff, or was this you sort of was this the exhibitors actually getting together and actually nutting heads themselves?
It's more of that. It's more of discussion groups and nutting heads, and the distributors are there, and they do get opportunities to present product, but it's a smaller window for them to do it, and we've gotten a lot of other things scheduled in. Whereas a lot of the other conferences I go to are more of a sales pitch. They've got all their lineups for the Christmas and so on, and it's all about trailers and what they're doing to market the films and so on, whereas this wasn't so much about that.
Right, so would it be fair to say, is there optimism, industry?
There's optimism. I think everyone's really keen on, a lot of people are starting to see the benefits roll through of full conversion to digital. So, no matter how many screens you got, once you've converted completely, then you can see some real benefits in how you operate. I think, a lot of them are seeing that now. And I think, they're all pretty upbeat about the lineup that's coming, the product that's rolling through. It's always good too. I always, catch up with guys who've been to CinemaCon. And they've seen a lot of the product that might be coming through for Christmas or little bits and pieces, and so you get a sense of how confident they are about some of the product. I mean, having said that, usually what once CinemaCon comes along, the content flows pretty quickly out after that. So, it'll hit Australia, it'll hit New Zealand pretty quick. But it's still good to knock heads with those guys and see what sort of feeling people are getting for some titles. Without going into boring detail, it's a good opportunity to meet and discuss and kind of in-house I guess amongst independents, and if you want to gripe and moan about certain things you can, and it's not really a public hearing in front of distributors.
Right. I read an interesting article talking about release patterns, an interesting article in one of the American websites. It's like they finally twigged that Hollywood is actually starting to release their blockbusters internationally first.
Mm.
and they're getting a bit upset about this. It's like, why is Australia getting Iron Man before us,
before.
Yeah. And some ways it's more than a week. It's it's partly to do with this much more money to be made internationally than there is domestically now. It's like three quarters of the money from those blockbusters is coming from the rest of the world.
But also, that was school holidays. So yeah. It's mapped around local sort of seasons,
and with something like Star Trek as well, as we know from Australia getting the first of the premieres, there were nine screenings around, as we know, because Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times was talking to us about her trip to Sydney to watch it last time. These launches are timed around the availability of the talent, so the stars of the movies, they've got a 2-week world tour where they have to go to 9, 10, 11 different cities to walk the red carpet, and they can't be in everywhere at once. So it's interesting how these situations are evolving. These scenarios are evolving over time. So, getting a little bit closer to home now, it's time to talk about a New Zealand documentary that is making its way around the country. Opened in Auckland a couple of weeks ago, I think. Opens in Wellington on Thursday, and that is Petra Brett Kelly's Māori Boy Genius. The latest entry in what seems to be a sort of golden age for New Zealand documentary is Petra Brett Kelly's Māori Boy Genius, which premiered at the New Zealand Film Festival last year, and it's now making its way around the country on general release. Petra, welcome to Cinematica.
Thanks very much. Great to be here. It actually had its world premiere at the Berlin Film Festival, but you're right, the New Zealand premiere was in... at the New Zealand Film Festival.
Well, that leads me to my first question then, I guess, which is that this is a film that is about a particular time in a boy's life, a 16-year-old Ngāruira Pumanawawhiti, who is an extraordinary character. But you finished the film at the beginning of last year, and so much will have happened to him since. I mean, so much of his, has his life unfurled the way that you were expecting it to?
No, not at all, actually. I mean, but I think that's the wonderful thing of documentary, is that you never know what's going to happen next. And, you know, I filmed with Ngāruira for 16 months, and I could have carried on for years and years, but at some stage you kind of have to go, yeah, I think I've got an ending, and let's just stop now. But no, I mean, and I called the film Episode 1, sort of hinting at the fact that this is just the start of his life, but also maybe in the future I would do a Part 2, and, you know, as his life continues. But, that's sort of the beauty, and I suppose why I remain addicted to documentary, is because you start something and you have this great idea and you write up this proposal and you try and get funding on a certain idea, and then, you know, life happens and the whole film shifts and you're kind of thrown something. But that's what I love about it, is, you know, being able to react and move and shift, and the story reveals itself.
Okay, tell us a little bit about how you found out about Ngāruira and what it is about him that is so special.
In that wonderful New Zealand way of everybody being connected, a friend of a friend of mine got in contact and said that she'd read this small article in a Hawke's Bay paper about this young boy, and we should get in contact with him. So my executive producer, Joanna Paul, and I flew down to meet Ngāruira and his father, Adrian, but I was really reticent at first because I just sort of thought, oh, yeah, a teenage New Zealand boy, he's not going to have much to say. But, you know, can he carry a film? But I met Ngāruira, and, you know, I met this remarkable, charismatic young man who was humble with it, because, you know, I hang out with people for long periods of time, so there's no way I want to hang out with somebody I don't like. And I was interested in sort of exploring, you know, how a young person develops their political ideas or their awareness, all of that sort of thing, because I'd read many years ago that when we're 16, apparently we start to realise our place in society, how we fit in, what we possibly don't like about it, those sorts of things, which I suppose are the start of our political ideas and, you know, our leaning. And so when I met him, I thought, okay, well, I'm not interested really in just doing a short story, a short profile on this kid and follow him to Yale. I want something of greater depth and also something that would resonate around the world and have sort of a commonality to it, because I always think, you know, of my films going global. And so I started with him, and, you know, there is a greater depth to his story. And obviously because the film has screened in many places around the world and been translated into a number of languages, it does have some concepts, you know, that others can find applicable to themselves.
It's something about him as well that he seems to appreciate, that his situation has a sort of global perspective or global impact, more so than anybody else in the film, I think.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I mean, he had never travelled before we started filming, so it wasn't like he was a well-travelled, well-heeled individual, and he was 15 when we started. So, yeah, but he has this sort of awareness, and I think he also, he reads a hell of a lot, you know, and he was addicted at the time to watching political TV, American political TV, you know, like live from the Senate. And so I suppose, you know, he kind of understood how some parts of the world work and what they're shaped on, and how that, you know, was relevant to him as well. So, yeah, he does have that understanding, definitely. And when we've travelled with the film, he's been able to sort of click in with many different people and different ages and, you know, in different languages even.
What did it take to for you to get access to the kind of access that you had to the family, to be able to spend that amount of time? Because it wasn't just him. You know, this is a portrait of a family that's also that's being tested in lots of ways. They know that they have to do right by this kid, but they're not sure whether they're actually able to.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's an ongoing process. I mean, when I start a film, I always say, as I said to Ngā Rawera and Asano, you know, why do you want to make this film? And we talked about it for a long time. And I had to remind them a number of times of that. Never Ngā Rawera. He never faltered. But the family, at certain times, his parents kind of pulled back. And it was a protection mechanism, really, because when he started to falter at Yale University, as parents do, you know, they surrounded him and they stopped communication with me. And they just wanted to protect him. But, you know, for me, I needed to carry on the film. And I also thought, oh, my gosh, I think something's happening that I should be a part of, because, you know, and I had to say to them, remember, you wanted to tell this inspirational story to inspire others, and you can't inspire without showing the pluses and the minuses, you know, the humanity to a story. And yes, okay, if he's not doing well, we need to show that, because otherwise people will just think, oh, yeah, he's just a genius and off he goes and I'll never be able to aspire to anything like that.
Yeah.
But because he did, you know, have these real tests of his abilities and his strength of character, then that makes the story more real and more, you know, understandable from a number of people. So, yeah, it's an ongoing thing. But the family were generally really amazing, really amazing. You know, even the fact that I knew, because his mother during the film gives birth to the sixth child, and I knew that there was no way I was ever going to be able to get there. You know, I'd get the phone call and then I'd have to get on a plane down to Napier. And so I sent them a small camera I have, and the dad, you know, said, well, here's what I'd want you to do. And he did it during the birth, you know, and then interviewed all the members of the family. I mean, it's extraordinary, their commitment. So, you know, I mean, They were amazing, but it is an ongoing, you know, it's a relationship that you continue to build through the film.
Yeah, I was going to ask you actually about that's the sequence or the set of scenes at Yale, because everybody's made such an enormous sacrifice to give him that opportunity. Is a rare opportunity for anybody from New Zealand to be able to go and study at Yale. That prestigious location, but to do it at his age, it is extraordinary. And when things start to falter, how quickly did you find out that things maybe were going off the rails slightly for him?
Yeah, so they were there for 10 weeks, and I knew I couldn't afford on my budget to stay the whole time. So my cameraman and sound, we went for the first 10 days, and then we were coming for the last while as well. And in the middle, like every day I was in contact with him or his dad, and I would send them questions and say, can you film this? Can you have a think about that? How are you feeling about this? And we'd have phone conversations as well. And then after about 4 weeks, so he was in his second block. So his first block, where he did two major courses, he did really well. And then he started his second block, and he felt completely out of his depth and thought he was failing, and there was no communication. It stopped completely, and I thought, okay, there's something happening here. So I did think at one stage, I'm going to have to hop on a plane and go there, but it's that whole thing of you're just so restricted by budget, and I was putting a lot of my own money, you know, I put over $100,000 into making this film, so at some stages I had to go, oh God, I just don't know that I can do this. So it was then that I got Joanna to call Makareta, his mum, down in Hawke's Bay, you know, who was meanwhile caring for five children on her own, and just appeal to her. And we were all in tears. Like, this went on for some days, the back and forth. So, you know, it was, I don't know if I've quite answered your question, but you know,
he must have such extraordinary reserves, this kid, because you can see the tension on his face when things start to get difficult, while he's homesick in Yale, the work is much harder than he was expecting, he's being tested much more than he ever has been before, but he seems to be able to just, you know, suck it up, doesn't he, and somehow work it out.
Yeah, I mean, he is has this amazing thirst for knowledge. You know, he really does want to read those books and learn this stuff and sit in those lecture theatres. It's not a chore. So he does have that thirst. I think that he became overwhelmed by all the other students at 22, 23, 24. You know, I think after a few weeks, he'd started to get homesick for his mates. We filmed that thing with our, you know, his friends back in New Zealand are Skyping with him. And so I think then it showed, yes, he was a teenager and these things were affecting him. But he seemed to still have a reserve, a maturity that did eventually pull him through that. And, you know, he tried to quit and they went to the registry, you know, registration office, and they said, well, you've paid, you don't get your money back, so you might as well carry on with the course. And he and his dad went, well, okay, let's carry on. And just sometime in that 24 hours of going, well, we're here, we've paid, so we might as well stay, I think there was this huge shift for him. And the fact that as a young person he can do that psychologically shows incredible strength. Mm. Because, you know, his dad is a remarkable person, but his dad doesn't have any stretch of the educational possibilities of his son. Yes, of course, he's bright and he's educated, but, you know, I think there's a scene where they're walking to a class and his dad's struggling over a word that they've just heard a lecturer say. And I think that scene shows that, you know, his parents and their bravery are saying, we cannot now, you know, be with you in an educational level. You're so much beyond us and, you know, and we will help you to go further, which is such a brave thing to do. They're basically saying, you're going to go so much further than we ever can imagine and we ever will be. So there was bravery on both sides. But, yeah, I mean, if you were to ever meet him, he's now 19, Ngaro Wera. And he is this remarkable, you know, sometimes quite old spirit and, you know, and just can fit into many situations and many different places.
Well, between you, you've made a pretty marvellous film, actually, and I'm really glad that it's going around the country. You're going around the country with it. Where are you now?
I'm in Gisborne. I'm just waiting for the second screening. So I've been at one screening this afternoon and another this evening. And then I head back to Whakatāne for some more screenings over there because we had sell-out screenings there last weekend. So they've asked me back. And then I'm on to Christchurch. So, yeah, it's the start. I've got more cinemas have signed up. I've now got 41 cinemas throughout New Zealand going to screen the film. So it's fantastic.
It's brilliant. Documentary making in New Zealand's turning into, it's like being a rock star on tour, isn't it?
Exactly the same. I don't think I've got screaming fans or underwear being thrown at me, but otherwise exactly the same.
All right. Petra, thanks very much for being on Cinematica. Best of luck with your film.
Thank you so much.
Oh, hello, Arthur.
What are you lot doing here?
We're going to be singing.
Better get some folks who can sing then.
Have you got a name? The OAPs? Oh. With a Z, though, to make it straight. Give me your rock and roll. Get stuck. I'm going to do solo.
On your own?
That's what a solo is, isn't it? Did Grandad tell you he came to hear us sing?
I wouldn't call it singing.
Why don't you join in? Lay some beats.
Well, I am. Bloody crackers, you lot.
A Song for Marion is opening all around the country on Thursday. And Simon, you're lucky enough to have seen it before anybody else does.
I'm always privileged with these things.
Yeah, I think you only get to see films before they open, don't you?
Yeah. If I can't see it before it opens, yeah, I don't watch it.
Exactly. You feel insulted, don't you?
I do. It's like, what happened here? Why haven't I seen Star Trek before the rest of the world? Mm. What's up with that? So, no. So, what do we got? We got here a nice British film for a more older audience, I think is how you describe it. You know, it stars Vanessa Redgrave and Terrence
Stamp.
I always think of Terrence Trent. But and they play this happily you know, married couple in their retirement years, have their routines and he's a bit of a grouch. And she's really this bubbly, effervescent sort of woman who, you know, embraces a lot of things and has a lot of enthusiasm. And so they're a good, you can kind of see, you know, how they work together. One of the things that she does is she, like a young at heart sort of choir group, she sings in it and they get modern versions and they spin them, you know, and sing them as seniors singing them and so on. And it's all, you know, quite nice. And then, really what happens is she's terminally ill And it's how he gets left on his own and has to deal with that. And he's this old grouch who blames these people for pushing it too hard and, you know, and you know, not wanting to share and things like that. And it's a really nice, sort of slightly teary in places film. I quite liked it. I thought that these people, you know, there's a bit of ham in there. There's a bit of sort of seniors doing sort of slightly cringy, silly things, I guess, you know, like trying to dance rock and roll or whatever, or do the robot, you know, and you kind of, but there's a real enthusiasm though, like, towards it all, and which pulls it off. And I think you know, the actors involved, like the lead actors, I mean, are all sort of pretty good, you know. They're all know what they're about and deliver it. I mean, there's Gemma Arterton's in there, and Christopher Eccleston's in there, who plays the son, and there's quite an interesting relationship between the son and the father, because he's not a very touchy-feely kind of dad, you know. He's pretty distant and pretty sort of short with his son, just can't sort of express his emotions, and particularly after Vanessa Redgrave's character passes away, you know, they become quite distant, and it's how that, you know, but there is a reconciliation, and it's quite well done, and it's got a really, really touching kind of last 20, like the song for Marion. So it is you know, I really enjoyed it. I think it's you know, it's not a big bash, crash and bash. Sort
is it going
of,
to be this film. Year's best exotic Marigold Hotel? Is it going to go? Is it going to play and play and play? Do you think?
Look, I think it will play for a while. I think it will. I think
because Quartet played for a long time.
Quartet
didn't it?
Played for a while. And to be honest, I preferred this to Quartet. You know, I mean, I thought Quartet. I don't know. I found the premise a bit kind of crazy. I mean, this is two sort of elderly people in their twilight years. You know, it's and some of the situations they have to deal with are quite believable.
Have you seen Young at Heart, the documentary about the similar situation, the choir, this American choir, isn't it, in that film? And I remember watching that without much of an idea about what that film was going to be about. It was at the film festival. I just had a stack of tickets, and I turned up from one screening to the next, went and sat down, and I was a puddle on the floor at the end of it. They had to mop me up. And you can see the potential for a film like that about that topic to do a similar sort of job. Is it gonna make mincemeat out of me, or am I, you know, because I'm a bit of a softy?
Well, I think if you can, look, it's quite emotional in places, and it's quite an emotional ending. I think there will be people coming out a little bit weepy and so on.
From Coldplay, does it finish with Coldplay?
No, I can't
because that was that young at heart. I was like, poor boy, I'm finished. I'm out now.
Yeah. So I think it does. You know, it is. Because he finds friends, you know, like there's a whole lot of things that happen where it's quite warm, but it's also quite sad in places. But it is quite a teary sort of film, in good ways, as well as sort of sad. So, I think it'll hit the mark.
Good, good, good. Look, I'm looking forward to it now. I'm going to have to put you on the spot because you're the only one around the table that's seen it, so you can't hide. Two words to sum up a song for Marion.
It's a... Well, it's a tearjerker.
Okay. That's good.
Bring your tissue. Well, you know, if you've got a little hanky up the sleeve, you'll be right.
Maybe pack a few more.
Yeah.
All right. That is excellent work from Simon. A song for Marion, opening all over the country at your favourite local purveyor of quality motion pictures. That is our show for this week. It's another big week next week. We interview one of the two directors of the Academy Award nominated True Life Adventure, Kon-Tiki, and I think some of you will have heard we played a sneak preview of that a couple of weeks ago, but we'll play the whole thing next week. And of course, we're going to be telling you, we're going to be running the ruler over Star Trek. We'll be giving you our verdict, whether it's 3D, whether it's IMAX, which Kaylee will be taking you all to on Friday.
No, I want to get taken too. Okay, wait, how about we just all pay our own way? We'll go Dutch on it.
Okay, but you all have to turn up at the same time, otherwise you won't be sitting together. It's no fun if you're not sitting together.
Yeah, so send me a tweet if you want to go watch it on Friday or Saturday. I'll be around.
You might get your tickets pretty quick.
Yeah, it'll be pretty busy, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's get organising, everybody. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica.
Cette fois, c'est le moment d'ouvrir une deuxième parenthèse et de décrire les sentiments des personnages.
If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can click subscribe in iTunes or whichever your Android favorite podcasting software is. And that way the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. And of course, feedback and reviews at iTunes and the other locations, super useful to help people discover the show. You can contact us to give us your two-word reviews, feed us back. At various
cookies.
various social media channels.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook on our page at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can find our two-word reviews, and on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
And the show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store as well. And we're going to leave you with some more music. There was not much to drag out of the more recent releases, so the best music that I heard in the last week at the movies was, in fact, from the New Zealand Film Festival's autumn events season, Michel Legrand's music to one of the daffiest art movies ever, Godard's Band Apart, which I saw on Saturday afternoon. This is the music from the famous dance sequence, which lasts about 4 minutes, where the three characters just get up from the cafe table and start dancing to the music on the jukebox. And I could have sworn that they were going to go Gangnam Style at one point, because it was like cross between line dancing. And anyway, it was nuts, and the music was fantastic. Until next week, that's all from me.
And goodbye from me.